to someone who could cherish me as much as I cherish you.
And we're back!
Practicing. Got a good month lead up for our ghost voice here, but it is the beginning of September now, and we're getting a little bit spookier, so we're going to eschew the Oscar sprint. We're going to take away from the track for a second. We're going to go delve into the supernatural and the horrors. We're kind of doing a lead up to The Nun, which is going to be the big movie of the first week of September, the big horror movie from the, I guess you can call it the Warren Cinematic Universe, right?
That's we love cinematic universes, and when this one popped up a couple years ago, yeah, we had to dive into it as moviegoers, and definitely, you know, we covered the MCU, we covered the MIU.
Connecticut residents, too. It speaks to us being right down the road here, so close to near and dear in our hearts.
Annabelle is 9 minutes away from where I live.
We're going to do two episodes covering the Warren universe. Back to back, you'll get those within a couple days of each other. We're going through the Warren cinematic universe. Again, once we're leading up to the movie event of The Nun, which we will cover. We'll probably be holding each other in each other's arms, terrified. I'm sure that looks the promotional material for that was too scary for general audiences.
Taken off of Facebook, so, yeah. Taken off of YouTube.
Couldn't have better press for a scary movie than that. But yes, we're going to do these in chronological order as we handle most movies in any aspect, really. So instead of covering just the Annabelles or just the Conjuring, we're going to do this in two episodes. Conjuring 1, Annabelle 1, in the next episode, Conjuring 2, Annabelle Creation. And that'll lead us into next week when we do cover The Nun as a movie event. But first, we want to talk about the Warren Cinematic Universe and cinematic universes in general, Michael.
Yeah, The Nun is looking at a $32 to $37 million box office right now, which is a sizable best popular film, Mike 1 stipulated.
If we go by certain landmarks that certain geniuses have proposed, then yes, I guess that would qualify.
Yeah, that would qualify for that category.
Absolutely. Anything above $30 million is kind of a big deal. That means you're pretty much guaranteed to hit the $100 million threshold domestically.
And it's the fifth film in the cinematic universe. Right now, they have Annabelle 3, an untitled Annabelle 3 project.
I saw that.
Planned for a July 2019 release date. So next summer, you'll be getting a third Annabelle movie.
So instead of Annabelle Creation, now it's going to be what, Annabelle Destruction?
They have... The Annabelle Apocalypse. They have a Crooked Man project in development.
Really? That's part of the Warren Jennings?
And they've written scripts for it. And James Wan is a producer. And they also, of course, have a Conjuring 3 in development that they're writing, that they're working on. Somewhere in the Warner Brothers studios, apparently there is a big timeline, a big board set up with all the Warren files basically up there in movies, and it's chronological that they what they would hope would become their cinematic universe. So, Mike,
I'm sure nothing happens in that room late at night after the lights are turned off.
No. So I just read a book.
Good for you.
Something to brag about. No, I just read a book, The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies by Ben Fritz. It's an awesome read on Audible. It's like 9 of our podcasts. So you can get our podcast for free or you can go buy books. But in this case, it's really fun. They cover the Sony hack. They basically cover how Marvel started its cinematic universe, how it kind of stumbled upon it, and how since then studios have just had that imperative to create cinematic universes. Mike, I had this question for you.
Let's go.
Could there be a more unlikely cinematic universe created with a $20 million horror film that they just probably hoped would do okay, right?
Yeah, it's kind of astounding in that you said it. The budget for The Conjuring was so small, $20 million. And that had such a big success. And then they must have thought that Annabelle would be kind of the end of it.
Right.
You know, okay, we have this creepy doll. We can at least make a movie about that, and that'll probably be it. Here's a paltry $6.5 million. Right. And then that was such a huge success financially, if not critically. So, no, can you think of a more likely, more unlikely product to spin into its own cinematic universe? Absolutely not. But this is obviously, we're in now the age of the cinematic universe. And you said it at the top, we like to cover them because they've kind of borrowed from TV, you know, where TV used to be episodic and season for season. Now it's gone to the movies, and we all can't get enough, apparently.
So I wonder if, you know, studio heads, and especially when you get a $20 million or a $40 million property horror movie, right? I wonder if studios are obviously they are hoping for that big Halloween type franchise to find a diamond in the rough, to strike a fire, you know, to start a fire in
merchandising.
So, yeah, so I'm sure their hopes for these projects would get there. But usually, like, the Blumhouse model is put into effect of the last 15 years, where you take those shots, but you take a lot of them for $1 million or $5 million or $10 million. Blumhouse sweet spot's kind of been the 5 to 15, right? There, where they do a lot of fives, and they'll do a few 15s, and they'll branch out and do a...
And just hope to hit something that goes
10
viral.
On Black Klansman, yeah. Right? Here you have a $20 million property from the writers of a $40 million property, House of Wax.
Mm-hmm.
And which probably did not make money. So
didn't
I'm just
well.
I'm just shocked. They have the Warren files. They have rights to some of those stories. They didn't have the rights to all of those stories. They probably do now, or at least they're trying to get them. But they found this cinematic universe kind of out of nowhere.
They also are lucky in a sense that the Warrens, I think, are pretty relatively well known, at least in the Northeast. I know they do, like, the high school loop and the university loop, and they've spent the last 20, 25 years traveling and kind of getting their name. We obviously have heard of the Warrens, regardless of this cinematic universe. So they are an established brand, so I think that helped them.
Right.
But I can't imagine you would expect worldwide success like these movies have had.
Yeah, to transition into who the Warrens are, they did. They came on lecture circuits to my hometown high school. Mm-hmm. You mentioned it a couple pods ago, to your mom's hometown high school there. Yeah, I mean, they have a few novels based on a few books they've written, but it's like, you know, 10 or 12 novels written about the Warrens. And otherwise, they're known as going on TV shows as paranormal investigators here. So to get into their bio briefly, Annabelle lives 9 minutes away from my house.
And it's a Raggedy Ann doll.
And so, Michael, yeah, don't be surprised if you ever ask me the question of what I want, that my answer to you would be, your soul!
Well, that's usually how we meet each other before every
recording
anyway.
I really tried for that.
No, I'm glad you went for it.
I'm a bad actor.
No, that's good for you.
I gave you the eyes, though. Anyway, Lorraine Warren resides to the currently and recently closed Warren Occult Museum. This was open for many, many years in Monroe, Connecticut.
It's a family dispute, I'm almost positive I read.
Okay. I think her nephew was helping her with the research Ed died. So Ed Warren was a World War II veteran and former police detective who became a self-proclaimed demonologist. He died in 2006 after a long career as a demonologist. Lorraine Warren is now 91. She is still living with us in Monroe, talking to dolls in her... unattended museum.
As
there.
You do.
She has claimed to be a clairvoyant and light trance medium. This husband and wife team worked as paranormal investigators on an alleged 10,000 cases, Mike.
You know what's amazing about all that, too, is how, like, the gravitas in which they're taken. Because you look at how many, Miss Cleo, and how many of these psychics that were throughout the 90s and early 2000s that people just saw right through. They knew they were shams, knew they were fake. But for me, anyway, people talking about people that have seen the Warrens live, they always buy into it. And they always, I guess, I never saw their presentations, but their presentations always seem to spook out my friends that did go, and always they bought it hook, line, and sinker. So I'm always shocked to hear how seriously the Warrens were taken as a demonologist versus a psychic, which we give basically a negative pejorative connotation to.
High schools are hosting their visits and their lectures, which is very interesting.
Exactly.
New England Society for Psychic Research, if I can speak today, that is their home base of operations. That they founded that society a way back. I wonder how they're viewed in paranormal investigative
circles. It's a very
circles.
Good question, yeah.
Like, are they, are people jealous? I mean, I'm sure it's a whole gamut of emotions, but are people jealous of them? I know that they've written a few books. They haven't written a ton of books, but many more were written about them, like I said, about their investigations. I don't want to mention all their notable cases here because I don't want to spoil you for other films.
I was going to say, the WB will. Warner Brothers will get on that soon enough. Just give them a couple years.
There's a lot of hauntings, a lot of murders, a lot of true crime stuff that they did investigate as well. They could easily make another two or three Conjuring films.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, with all these monsters.
I think they're going to.
Yeah, you can have more spinoffs. All right, so Mike, as a teaser for both movie reviews here, I read a recent article about Lorraine visiting her old stomping grounds at Laurelton Hall. That was her Catholic all-girls high school, still there in Milford, Connecticut today.
Yeah, something we know very well.
She told the girls at a lecture at the early 2010s that in her occult museum, the relic or object that she was most afraid of is the Annabelle doll. This is a Raggedy and Dahl.
Yeah. Yeah, right, and I thought it was a nice touch at the without going into spoilers, this will be spoiler free throughout these two movie reviews, but at the end of Annabelle there is a shot of a Raggedy Ann doll in the background,
right,
which I thought was a nice touch. But yes, if you go on their website, there is the Raggedy Ann doll encased in the enclosure just like in the movie. Very, very creepy.
So apparently Lorraine put up a sign from the get-go, do not touch the glass housing this doll. And the claim that she made at this lecture when the journalist wrote the article about it was that one person in all her time that she's known or opened the museum, one person touched the glass.
There always has to be one, doesn't there?
And he died in a motorcycle accident not long afterwards.
Now, whether that's coincidence or demons, I don't care. Just respect people's wishes.
So, yes, so we're going to get into The Conjuring, which opens up with an Annabelle prologue, and, of course, Annabelle 1 here today. The cast and crew, Mike, for The Conjuring.
Loaded.
Yeah.
And I remember, again, when The Conjuring came out, I talk kind of previewing expectations here, that, like, it was just another horror movie.
Right.
And then you dig into the Patrick Wilson, Vera Farmiga, you know, you're going to get to all the names, and it's like, these are established actors. These are actually like hardcore thespians.
Yeah, director James Wan. He had like a few flops, like Death Sentence with Kevin Bacon, and he also did a movie.
Well, let's be careful of not saying things we can't take back, all right?
He had a couple flops, like Death Sentence with Kevin Bacon,
dare you, sir.
And another one, like Dead Silence with another doll.
Listen, Dead Silence, have you ever seen it? No, listen, honestly,
I've never seen it.
Dead Silence is a decent horror movie. It is not bad. It's a fun little romp.
But James Wan's breakout success, of course, was Saw.
Yes.
That was like a Blumhouse model, very small, independent horror film.
Instant hit,
became a monster hit and a huge franchise. So Insidious 1 and 2, he'd later go on and direct those in the Conjuring vein with Patrick Wilson, one of the stars from this Conjuring movie.
A lot of crossovers between the Conjuring franchise and the Insidious franchise.
James Wan is basically a producer on all these films, and his big breakout as a director in terms of the size of his projects has been Furious 7, which he knocked out of the park, many of us think.
Now, that's something I haven't seen. I haven't delved into the Fast and Furious franchise too much. I
didn't see 8.
We talk about it a lot lately. I just keep bringing it up, so maybe that's something we'll have to do
at some point. And he's also the director of the upcoming Aquaman for the DCEU there, Mike. We're a little worried about that film.
I'm hopeful, but
he'll go on to direct Conjuring 2. I was just surprised that they gave this budget to an R-rated horror franchise. I guess it's WB going for it.
$20 million it's not inconsequential, but it's not huge.
Today, that kind of quote-unquote low to mid-budget movie isn't made as much, right? It's made back in old studio system days.
You're probably right, but the old standby in Hollywood has always been that there's money in horror movies, right? You can make them for low budget, and sometimes if you just find something that works, they're easy to make money off of. So maybe that's what their thinking was here.
But it's strange because they hired Chad and Carrie Hayes, the brothers Hayes, from House of Wax, The Reaping, and Whiteout to pen this script.
Ask me if I'll defend House of Wax.
Will you?
No.
Okay. Because those movies, at least in terms of box office mojo, do not seem to be profitable. Now, that was back in the DVD buying heyday, so maybe this is before, digital.
Well, the big hubbaloo with the remake of House of Wax was that Paris Hilton showed her boobs on an actual cinematic movie instead of a home movie. And so that was, how long ago was Paris Hilton the it girl as opposed to the Kardashians? So we're talking early 2000s.
So people like Mike bought this on video, apparently.
I have a couple copies.
So essentially, I wonder if it made up its money on video and it became profitable so that like 10 years later, these
guys
got another.
Amongst the horror world, it's kind of, and nobody's really crazy about it that I've seen anyway.
But $68 million box office off a $40 million budget, that's not in the black.
No, probably not,
Reaping has an unlisted budget, made $62 million. And it can't be good either. Mm-mm. So perhaps their stories, resonated.
So it was a gamble.
Yeah, this is a gamble, but it might have resonated on video. We don't know. Vera Farmiga is the protagonist of this film. She's
so
Lorraine Warren from The Departed, Up in the Air, and Bates Motel. Infuriatingly, will investigate every single noise, Michael. She will never walk away, and that's my probably biggest qualm with all these horror movie protagonists.
You don't like that the demonologist and the clairvoyant doesn't let noises in the night go?
I don't like that they go towards the noise. Especially,
could you imagine that movie? Oh, there's a sound over there. We got to
get the fuck out. That's why I love Get Out. I love Get Out. Get the hell out of there. That's his whole...
It's just, they hear a bumper in the hallway and they leave the house and then credits roll.
See ya. I love... Let's make a short film with that as our plot line where somebody finally... Where they don't recognize that a ghost is playing games on them.
Be unexpected.
That's a great short story right there. I just came up with it on the fly. Wouldn't you see that or wouldn't that surprise you and make you laugh?
If I pay full price for it, I would be furious.
No, it's a short film. It's a short story. It's perfect. I love myself. My mind right now. Nobody else.
You're doing
does.
God's work.
Okay. Ed Warren is played by Patrick Wilson from Watchmen, Hard Candy, of course.
Hard Candy. What a movie.
Oh, yeah. He'll go on to star in the Insidious films. And of course, I think it was season one of the Fargo TV series. No, I'm sorry. Season two, I think. He makes some hilarious faces throughout these two Conjuring films, Mike. If I wasn't pooping myself in fear, I think I'd be laughing at his vaudevillian, you know, mannerisms. All those slipperoos and all those crazy faces, man, that he makes in both movies.
He's going for it. He's got to play shocked and terrified, and he's the one that's kind of chasing it, whereas Vera Farmiga's character is on top of it most times. So.
True, true. Ron Livingston from Office Space.
Yeah, hi, Peter. I'm going to have to ask you to come in and work Saturday.
Yeah, man, with the dream of doing nothing there. I love that.
I got a meeting with the Bobs.
He is the dad husband from Tully. In my mind, he gives a James Franco at the Oscars performance in this one, Mike.
So that's not a compliment.
Not a compliment. I like Ron Livingston. This performance
I will say at the ending, the ending scene where he's kind of got to give a motivational speech to his wife through some shit going on. Yeah, I wasn't really buying that he was quite so terrified, but whatever.
I think his eyebrows, they don't raise at all throughout this whole
movie. You should have been an esthetician, man. Your obsession with eyebrows and hairlines.
Maybe
is just
his
amazing.
Eyebrows don't move. I don't know. But I think they don't raise enough for my liking. They're big, bushy eyebrows.
All right.
Just the choices you can make as an actor. You know,
Ron, if you could move your eyebrows a little.
When your phantom family is being hunted by a demonic force from Hades, you think you would just go, ooh, you know, once in a while.
Yeah, listen. I know this ghost is chasing us, but your eyebrows have not moved.
All right, Lily Taylor, she is an Emmy nominee from The X-Files, 6 Feet Under, and American Crime. I know her from High Fidelity. She's one of the crazy girlfriends early in High Fidelity with John Cusack there.
She's a good creepy actress. Like, yes. She played that role pretty well.
She is the haunted mother of this story of this family. She definitely has the juicier acting job and has, you know, she has a lot of chops. She's been nominated. She's Emmy nominated.
She went for it, too, when she had to, yeah.
The kids are Shanley Caswell, Haley McFarlane, Joey King, Mackenzie Foy, and Kyla Deaver. There's 5 haunted daughters as well. So, Mike, you have the specs for us.
Yeah, some specs for The Conjuring, directed by James Wan, saw an Insidious fame, obviously, written by Chad Hayes and Carrie Hayes, who have a history of numerous TV movies prior to this, such as First Daughter, Horse Sense, and Shutter Speed.
So they worked their way up to House of Wax.
Like also, Mike told you, the 2005 remake, the screenplay for House of Wax, which, again, Paris Hilton showed her boobs on screen.
I would saw off my left foot to have any of their careers right now.
Yes, we say it. I think that's a given with us. Movie debuted July 15, 2013 at the Cinerama Dome in L.A. What a great name. And went wide a couple days later, July 19th of 2013.
I want to go see a movie at the Cinerama
Dome. Sunday.
Nice.
112-minute runtime and an R rating, produced by New Line Cinema, the Saffron Company, and Evergreen Media Group, distributed by Warner Brothers, as all these Warren Cinematic Universe films will be. Budget, like we talked about, of $20 million, and it blew that bad boy straight out of the water, pretty much right from the get-go, as thanks to a riveting promotional campaign, it opened at number one its opening weekend, taking in $41.8 million domestically.
Wow.
Over 2,900 theaters for an average of $14,400 per theater, which was good at the time for the 23rd biggest R-rated opening weekend ever, and still today stands as the 35th ever on the same list. So we're in the top 40 openings for an R movie ever.
Strong.
Would go on to a $319.5 million worldwide box office, eclipsing its budget just domestically by more than $100 million. Domestically, it did take in $137.3 million, and the international rake the remaining $182 million total. again making over $300 million as is in worldwide. 7.5 IMDb scoring 366,000 plus reviews. Certified fresh and Rotten Tomato 86% on 211 reviews, 182 of them positive. Average critic score is 7.2 out of 10. It carries an 82% audience score on 158,000 reviews. Average audience score 4 out of 5. 68 meta rating, which is very high for a horror movie.
Sure.
With two perfect 100 scores, 8 total scores of 88 or higher, 9 total scores of a 60 or lower, and the low score of a 25 from Simon Abrams of RogerEbert.com.
Well, other than Simon Abrams there, critics loved it, audiences loved it, and it made perhaps 270 in terms of 270 million by our crass formula.
Probably, yes. Yeah,
I mean, it's maybe, a little less if the marketing costs that are not factored into their budget or
the
whatever.
WB but Frog was just rolling around in $100 bills from this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you're going to start a cinematic universe, you need something like this to get it going.
This had to be a surprise hit, like you brought up, too. There's no way. They probably thought this was good for maybe a $20, $50 million profit, but this took $182 million internationally for a domestically made horror film. It's a big deal.
Yeah, awards. Empire, Saturn, IGN, and Golden Schmo voted it for the best horror film of that year. Again, good publicity for it. So the plot of The Conjuring, Mike, we're going to give you a premise essentially here and kind of give you some information about, you know, early Act 2 stuff, maybe mid-Act 2 stuff, but we're going to try to be non-spoiler.
Yeah, our focus, like Mike just said, we're going to be non-spoiler about these movies, these two half episodes we're doing, but our focus is kind of the cinematic universe of the Warrens leading up to The Nun, not so much the particulars. The plot, what IMDb has listed down for the premise, paranormal investigators Ed and Lorraine Warren work to help a family terrorized by a dark presence in their farmhouse. Pretty minimalist, but that's actually, it's not a complicated story in so much as you have a family, you got a demon that wants to attach itself to it, and you got these two investigators that have been seeked out by the mother for help.
The parent family moves into a haunted house. They play right into the demon's hands with every single thing they open up every door, every wardrobe, the secret other basement of horrors.
This was just killing you. You just couldn't stand them doing investigating.
But it's so much fun because they play all these games, right? All these childish games. And I love this about horror movies because it's so, you know, it makes for so many payoffs in terms of a screenwriter and screenwriting because you have them play hide and go seek with claps.
Oh, it's hide and clap. Yes.
Hide and clap. And then that comes up at least twice more with the kids again and then the mother.
If you're a character, just to get meta about it, if you're a character and you know you're a character in a horror movie, why would you ever agree to play a game called hide and clap?
It's also fun that they really play off the paranormal investigator craze that was happening in the 2010s there, Mike, in late 2000s. I think that's when it was because you had Paranormal Activity, you know, making money, but you also had like reality TV shows.
Ghost Hunters.
You had all that stuff going on.
Really good
And the first line in the premise is paranormal investigators.
Bang, bang.
Right? Yeah. So they're just going right in with that high concept. So essentially, Ed and Lorraine Warren investigate weird occurrences. They investigate an early one in this movie that just turns out to be leaky pipes, and they explain it away. But when they go to the parent family house, it's immediately different from the other fake claims, and there's like alarm bells going off.
Well, they are accosted while giving a lecture in a school.
Yes.
We're talking about the three steps of a demon getting themselves into a body and taking over a body.
Again.
Infestation, oppression, suppression, whatever it
was. Classroom scenes, lecture scenes come true in movies. But you have them accosted, they go investigate, and all the red flags that they recognize, they immediately tell the family, Mike, this reminded me of the Sarah Paulson character in the new Glass trailer, where she's just like telling, let me tell you loonies how crazy you actually are in the psych ward. So the mother of the parent family is basically like, you know, asking an innocent question like, oh, what is that smell? And Ed Warren's like, well, that's obviously a demon that wants to drag your soul to hell, and it won't stop until it does so, no matter where you run or hide.
So what are you having for dinner tonight? You're right. There's no preface. There's no setup. I guess, though, thinking about it in kayfabe, quote unquote kayfabe terms, if you do go to these experts that are demon experts, you're not exactly wanting them to sugarcoat it. You want them to say there's something wrong, right?
I wonder if Ed Warren was like that back in the day. If he was just like, always
I smell sulfur. There's an army of darkness surrounding you right now.
It's attached itself to your aura, and it won't stop.
It's going to eat you from the inside. So how are you?
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of remember like The Exorcist and basically all the priests and that being like, I mean, we've just seen paranormal investigators. Maybe we should look into that. They kind of internalize it. They don't tell the family to freak right. them the hell out. But of course, Ed Warren, just both movies, he is just the voice of doom.
So that's the setup. That's the basic plot we have. The Warrens basically combining their efforts with this Perrin family to fight the demon. Lorraine figures out the backstory and the origin of the demon. I don't want to get into spoilers. We're trying to keep these spoilers free.
Right. So we're going to allude to some of our best scenes. I kind of already did two of mine, the cat clap game. And of course, I just the awesomely badness of Ed Warren freaking people out.
what I had is it's not a best scene, but why aren't horror movies more frequently nominated for sound mixing and sound editing? Right. Because it's the reliance essential. On the sounds, yeah. I mean, when you have birds hitting the window, which is the same exact sound as a door slamming,
right.
and it's cutting scenes to make you think it's the same thing. I thought the sound was so great. It was so effectively used, as it usually is in these big horror movies. And that's kind of why they're... Now, The Conjuring 2, I'll talk about anyway, the lack of sound and how that was used. They do a lot of silence-based stuff. But this one was very sound-driven, score-driven. I know the score is separate from the sound, but I thought the sounds in this were really effective and really scared the shit out of me, to be honest.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I rewatched these films late at night for the most part. And
that's a mistake.
I ratcheted up the sound, and it is. It's freaks you out.
Yeah,
and it's
totally.
Very effective. James Wan knows exactly what he's doing. So the other kind of best scene I had, Mike, was a scare involving a clothesline or, you know, the cloth on a clothesline.
Yeah.
I thought that was so brilliant. I guess as an honorable mention, I'd say the little girl getting haunted for the very first time while she's sleeping.
That was up there for me.
That was pretty good.
The ending as well, the involving the bedsheet at the end, where there's a slit in the bedsheet and we kind of see something. I thought that was very creatively done.
A lot with bedsheets.
Yes. Very big, very bedsheet intensive movie.
So the worst scenes, Mike, the worst scene in any horror movie to me, and this goes for Veronica that we've reviewed in our Netflix pod, how do these girls just go back to sleep? It's just beyond dumb.
Because they don't know it's a demon yet.
I get it when they make it seem like it's all a dream.
They have childlike wonder. To them, this is supposed to happen, right? They grew up on cartoons.
If you just got the living bejesus scared out of you by something that happens in this movie, and it's obvious that they're scared out of their minds, and then like the next scene is them waking up in the morning.
Yeah, it's a new day. Birds are chirping, the sun is shining bright. That horrible monster with 18 eyes and claws
for
hands isn't there anymore.
Into exhaustion?
Yeah, sure.
I don't know.
It's a good point. Yeah,
if you see a door slam shut,
right,
and then cut to the next scene where they wake up in the morning, ooh, I guess we fell asleep somehow. No, of course you're not going to sleep.
I liked how Lionel Richie was referenced. A little dancing on the ceiling happening in this movie.
They have.
I liked how Huey Lewis in the news, the message of the power of love overcame. That was kind
Very
of the message. A lot of 80s references being introduced that I thought, that
this
I
is
saw.
Mike telling me he wants to do another Best Original Song episode from the 80s.
It's tough. I mean, worst scene for me, I don't really have. I appreciated... I kind of focused more on the positive, I guess, because I am such a sucker for horror. Everyone knows that if they've listened to us. Mm-hmm. The locator, whoever picked this set, whoever found that tree deserves a raise.
Sure.
Because that tree belongs in a horror movie. And it's so effective that they actually have that on like the cover of the Blu-ray and stuff. And like, it's just that tree.
Very
that's
true.
The Conjuring tree. But that one branch that's off at like a right angle, it's just so perfect for a horror movie.
I wonder if they picked the tree or picked the house or found both at the same time. Yeah, I'm curious about that production story. That's... If we really did our homework, we should
So I took your negative and I just added more positives because I'm a sucker for horror.
All right, so could we kind of have two little segments to finish up here with. The prologue and epilogue kind of fit this into the Warren Cinematic Universe. Where else does it fit for us, Mike? How does it
fit? It's the surprise beginning. I don't think there is a Warren Cinematic Universe without this thing taking off. I don't think it was in the... maybe Annabelle, again, was in the plans. But I don't think this was supposed to be a Conjuring 2, Conjuring 3 type deal.
Yeah, I mean, they set you up with an Annabelle prologue to kind of give you,
right,
you know, who the paranormal investigators are, who Ed and Lorraine are, in a way, or it leads up to that. But then they lead you out with Dahl in the case, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's no surprise because it's in the trailers for, right, the next movie. So that's fascinating, like, that they had the cinematic universe in their minds, at least, going in, and that at least one spinoff going in.
They had to be tickled pink, too, because they spent less than $30 million to produce two movies that brought in $500 million.
Yeah, they got to be absolutely thrilled. Warner Brothers is doing backflips, yeah, the last 10 years at this. The modus operandi of the paranormal investigators, of this whole storyline that they basically reproduce at least three more times, we'll see what happens in The Nun. That general through line, once you bring in the paranormal ghost hunting thing, you kind of get a bit of a procedural there, which makes for a familiar template. So you basically get the same through line for all four of these movies.
Like a detective story, kind
of. Or at least three out of the four. Yeah. Well, at least the two Conjuring movies, let's just say,
right,
that.
Right.
The other two kind of take a different plot line, although the modus, like I said, that's why I wrote it down. The modus operandi of the demons is established here, and it kind of plays throughout the rest of them. And then they play off of this as like, all right, this is a fundamental I keep saying this Latin and I can't pronounce it, modus operandi of the demon, but then the nun will take a different twist on it,
yeah,
and she'll lie on purpose,
and with the nun and with the demon, I don't know why I didn't expect it to be so, but there are religious overtones in both this and Annabelle. The nun obviously has religious overtones. I didn't expect them to be hit so heavy, but in this movie, Lorraine tells Ed how God brought them together for a purpose, and that's kind of the big crux of how they finish this movie, too, in the finale. Annabelle will talk about how one of the characters there says her daughter said God had a higher purpose for me, blah, blah, blah. So there's a lot of references to a higher power and a higher purpose.
The last podcast on the left made a joke about them being Christian superheroes. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I mean, I kind of grew up in the church, and I don't see them as following the rule.
Well, they don't seem overly religious. I mean, they talk to a priest.
Yeah, I mean,
priest, and
Ed
they
is,
do an exorcism. Yeah, I can
Ed
see
is a
it.
Faith-based warrior for sure, and she is kind of on the fringe, I guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, I would classify her as more of the occult than I would,
yeah,
religious.
She's clairvoyant. Yeah. She's a medium. So yeah, a lot of Christians I know would take offense,
right,
to her.
Right. I don't see
though.
Her. Yeah, I'm with you there.
But she's definitely a spiritualist, and they both, sure, buy into the scientific research angle, which I think worked very well for all the way going back to The Exorcist. When you put that in, it gives the film like a little credibility.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
By association there, so that's interesting.
It was a mixture of factors that I think really helped this out. One, I think Warren's notoriety, I think the way the script was handled, the seriousness of the subject matter, too, and you didn't really offend it. You didn't go with the overtly Christian overtone. Yeah, you have the mentions of God, you have religion, it does play, right, a part, but they waited until the third movie of this cinematic universe, really, to kind of, or at least the end of the second one, to kind of really investigate that higher calling possibility.
Very true.
And then they introduced the nun, and then obviously.
But yeah, there's the mixture of elements here is why this movie hit, which was the last segment I had written down, but we flowed right into it. Look at us with our transitions.
We're almost pros.
But there's really no Oscar lens in this movie, and so that's why we wanted to talk about why it's such a box office success.
Why? I mean, there's no, this movie was a commercial success, basically a critical success. That's why Get Out is so special, damn it.
Right.
It was a horror movies are so hard to make Oscar worthy, and when you have one, it's what we talked about in the last episode, how something that transcends its genre should be celebrated, and Get Out is going to be a big theme any episode we do for me. I'm always going to try,
absolutely,
to tie back to it because it was just special.
And
but anyway.
You know, this year you have that effect, you know, or that torch being passed to Hereditary.
Right, right.
Another movie.
Anytime a horror movie can speak bigger. Yeah.
We're hoping we get some more. So, Annabelle, Mike, we're moving into the first spinoff. cast and crew here, directed by John R. Leonetti, the director of photography, a.k.a. cinematographer on The Conjuring. Leonetti was a well-known cinematographer.
A lot of horror movies.
Yeah, 38 credits to his IMDb. His only other directing credits were Mortal Kombat Annihilation and The Butterfly Effect 2 before this movie.
Did you see Butterfly Effect 1?
I did see the number 1 there, and it was terrible.
You didn't like it?
I hated it.
Oh, no.
I hated it back then. I don't know. I haven't rewatched it. But that was Ashton Kutcher, correct?
Oh, sure was. And Amy Smart, yes. Okay. Who was in everything from like 1999 to 2005.
I remember it being a very cool movie and me resenting it back in the day. So you were cool.
It doesn't make sense people liked if you it. Think about
the
it.
Cool people liked it. Yeah, no, I don't like the endless array of butterfly effects because you could just say, all right, well, why didn't the world end?
Or why didn't exactly, yeah.
Okay, so the great thing about this film, you know, it's we're going to talk about a lot of negatives, but the great thing is it brought us Gary Dauberman. He is a screenwriter who would eventually write the second Annabelle movie, which I liked for sure. The Nun, which we're going to talk about at the end of this whole little series here, mini series. And he, of course, is the writer for the two It movies. And
yeah, he's kind of got his career all settled out. It, I thought, was one of the most complete horror movies I've ever seen.
Yes.
It's strictly a horror movie, though. It doesn't aspire to be anything more, but loved it.
Dauberman is attached to writing the third Annabelle film, the second It chapter, and Swamp Thing, Mike. He is going to write the adaptation of Swamp Thing.
Swamp Thing has been like kicked around Hollywood forever, ever since that 80s TV series, and they just never seem to land on it. We'll see.
Yeah, he's kind of cutting his teeth here, and I think this cinematic universe, if you make money for it, they don't care what your critical scores are necessarily, because this movie made a shit ton of money, and they went back to this screenwriter for again and again.
I also find it interesting how they just kind of handed the reins of producer over to James Wan. Like, great job with the first movie. He is now kind of the protector of the Warren cinematic universe to bring it to life, really.
Yeah, he's playing a role. Of it, yeah. So Annabelle Wallace stars as the protagonist, Mia. She's one of those...
How's that for a meta joke?
Oh, yeah, right? Well, she's one of those faces, like, where did I see her from? She is from Peaky Blinders, the new Mummy remake, which didn't do that well. But I also saw her as the Wall Street Reporter in the new movie Tag, I really liked that movie. Made me laugh a lot. And she's a seamstress / pregnant first-time mother in this film. And, of course, she's a collector of rare antique dolls. Listen, Mike, her character, because this actress is really good in other stuff, but her character is a moron with a capital Mo.
Not a fan of Mia's decisions in this one, huh?
She is one of the dumber protagonists I've seen in a while. I like her. I like the actress, but good Lord. Her bimbo husband, who's also very dumb, is played by Ward Horton. He is a doting husband from the very beginning. He's a good husband.
White knight. I mean, this is a little misogynistic. He's always there to bring her out, huh?
But of course, this idiot bimbo is the procurer of rare antique demon-infested dolls.
Once again, if you're a character in a horror movie, why do you collect antique dolls? You know one is haunted at some point.
So they messed up the formula here, Mike, because there's not a young priest with the old priest. There's just an old priest. Tony Amendola from The Mask of Zorro and Lone Star plays Father Perez.
May God have mercy on your soul!
That's a great scene. Great makeup in that scene, too. I like that. Alfred Woodard plays Evelyn. She's the mom from Love and Basketball that we reviewed previously. We loved her work. She's also in Passion, Fish, and 12 Years a Slave.
She's another one with one of those faces that you're like, I know I've seen
character
you a billion places.
Yeah. Character actress in a ton of great stuff. So that's basically the notables in the cast and crew there. Mike, you have the specs.
Specs for Annabelle, written by Gary Dauberman. Like Mike said, kind of came from out of nowhere. It's been a go-to name for horror. He's got the screenplay rights to It, It 2, Annabelle, Annabelle Creation, The Nun, etc. Directed by John R. Leonetti, who was, again, a cinematographer on horror movies such as Mortal Kombat, Insidious, and Piranha 3D, Butterfly Effect 2, and Mortal Kombat.
I love the cinematography of the Insidious movies.
There's a lot of crossover between Insidious and the Conjuring universe. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
That makes sense.
Debuted September 29th, 2014 at the TCL Chinese Theater in LA and went wide October 3rd of 2014. Shorter runtime, about half hour shorter than Conjuring 1, 98-minute runtime and an R rating, produced by New Line, Atomic Monster Productions, which is James Wan's production company, and the Saffron Company, distributed again by Warner Brothers. Reviews weren't great and pretty much stayed that way throughout the theatrical run. 5.4 IMDb rating on 111,000 plus reviews. Rotten 29% Rotten Tomato critic score at 124 reviews, only 36 of those being positive. Mm-hmm. Average critic score of 4.4 out of 10. Audience score is barely better at 36% on 49,000. Average score of 2.9 out of 5. 37 meta rating on 27 critical reviews. High of a 70, but 8 scores of a 30 or lower with a single 0 score from Kyle Anderson of Entertainment Weekly.
Love called people out here.
If you have something that's so astonishingly lower than everyone else, I think it deserves higher.
They want
I would do the same if it was
and,
above.
Yeah. When we're seeking attention, we'll do the same. Cinema score, Mike, was a B.
And that's kind of where I'm going with this. The money was there. So critical scores be damned. This thing made money. It was made for a $6.5 million budget. Yeah.
And because the audience scores aren't as terrible as the critical scores. You have 5.4. So you have 50s, but then you have 30s in critics, but you have 50s in audience scores.
Obviously.
Except for the Rotten Tomato audience score.
Right. I mean, it found people that liked it. It went on to $84.2 million domestic box office, including a $37.1 million opening weekend. It's 84.2 at the end of its theatrical run, made it the 15th highest grossing R-rated horror movie ever. And the international box office pulled in another $172.7 million. Its worldwide box office ended up at $257 million, so it made roughly 40 times its original budget.
Wow.
I mean, that's what more could you ask for?
6.5 and coming away with 257. And it's crazy because the R-rated horror movie, that's directed at 20-somethings for the most part, right? It's not direct. Like, you think 13-year-olds would go see a movie like this, but no. I mean, maybe they're sneaking in or they're getting brought to it, but yeah.
I mean, there had to be some disappointment because a $37 million opening weekend to make only 82, quote-unquote, only 82 million, that is a drop-off.
Yes.
Because usually if you break 30, you want to break 100.
And yet...
a lot of money, 40
we'll,
times its
we'll
budget.
Talk about the does that have an effect on the next movie in the next episode we do on this series, so I guess we'll get there. Some awards though, Mike, again I'm getting conflicting reports here. It's nominated for the best horror film at the Saturn and Empire Awards.
Those are big. I mean, those treat horror with reverence. Yeah.
It's nominated for best thriller at the People's Choice Awards. That's okay because maybe it's an audience, you know, it made money. But Fangoria, and of course all the critics, Fangoria nominated it for the worst film at their Chainsaw Awards.
Huh. Interesting. So the plot premise coming from IMDb again, quote, a couple begins to experience terrifying supernatural occurrences involving a vintage doll shortly after their home is invaded by satanic cultists. Here's my question. Right from the start, if you're going to reference the Manson family like they did in the news thing,
right?
Why are you referencing a different satanic cult as if there were just a billion satanic cults running around the suburban streets of California?
Because that is the paranoid fear of vaguely religious horror movies that they're trying to work up in you.
But you're
just like the 90s did.
But so here's... But,
have you ever
so
seen Paradise Lost, the documentary series of the true crime?
Not the whole thing because they were like 3 hours each. But
so
yeah.
they actually did a recent documentary.
Right, they followed up on it.
And that's one of my favorite documentaries of the last 10 years, at least. I've only seen it once, but one of my favorite documentary experiences because it takes the whole saga and it goes through the whole saga. HBO does a film every 5 years or so.
Yeah.
I think they have 4 or 5 of them. But
anyway, they're 3 hours. They're long. Yeah.
It's supposedly an occult murder because there was an occult murder craze late 80s, early 90s that everybody was freaking out
over. But think
about
what this means in that cinematic universe, okay? So in the Conjuring Annabelle cinematic universe, that means the Manson family exists. Nice. These other cult horror things exist. Why can't we work towards a cult civil war then? Let's show that movie. It's not The Purge.
Cult versus cult.
Yeah.
I kind of like that. Again, we're coming up with multiple ideas for screenplays in this episode, Mike. I had one earlier. You have one now.
Flexing our creative
muscles.
I'm
into both of those ideas. And if you are, let us know and we'll write this up.
Anyway, now, clearly, she's not dipping that pickle into that mustard. I mean, that's my biggest takeaway, my biggest gripe from this movie. when she's pregnant, she's got the craving. She's like, pickles. Ooh, you know what would be great with this? Oh, you got me mustard. Pickles and mustard. She's dipping the pickle in the mustard. She's not dipping that pickle in the mustard.
There's something
that's not a sexual innuendo. She has a pickle and a jar of mustard, and she's not dipping the pickle into the mustard.
I'm so lost right now, but I'm also intrigued. You need to explain this further. I need you to elaborate.
So there's the scene where she's sitting at the table pregnant. Yes. And her husband walks in with a bag of groceries.
Okay.
And she's like, he's like, I got your stuff in case you have any pregnancy cravings.
All right.
And she's like, I don't really have any pregnancy. Ooh, pickles, because he just brought out the jar of pickles.
Right.
And she goes, you know, it'd be great with this. And he slides over the jar of mustard.
Okay. So that's
she's
just
like,
little...
oh, great. Pickles and mustard. She takes the pickle. She dips it in the mustard and pulls the pickle out. That pickle's got no mustard on it. No mustard.
So that's a continuity error that you've made this elaborate joke about.
they're lying to me.
Which we've taken much too much enjoyment out of ourselves.
Yes.
They're lying to you. Yes. No, the script girl sucks. Or whoever's doing the continuity, which is not. I think this movie, in terms of
worst scene.
It's bad scene. It's good. However, I'm going to have something that I hate more. But you're right. I think this character is dumb. So if she's.
These characters are not good.
Yeah.
These two characters combined, even for horror movie stakes, they're not great.
It's a bit. Well, and here's the thing. It's not a coincidence because the doll is basically sent. Once the idiot bimbo husband brings a haunted doll there, the doll that looks like the spawn of Satan.
why
are we collecting that thing?
Did they make it too evil looking? I know it's supposed to be
creepy.
No,
it's perfectly evil looking for selling the story.
Right, but why would you buy that doll? And why would you always want that doll?
Right.
Right, like, so that's what I mean. Like, is that too unbelievable?
Look, I mean, at least in the Child's Play movies, the good guy doll.
Chucky's enjoyable. Chucky looks
kind of cute. Yeah, he looks a little cute.
That's exactly my point.
Right.
But so we see her other porcelain dolls, and they're like actual, these beautiful dresses. And then Annabelle, she just looks terrifying.
Yeah, unless you're like a goth person, which right. We like those people. They shop at Hot Topic for their kids.
I loved shopping at Hot Topic when I was a teen,
by the way. Would buy Annabelle doll and just have their kids growing up on the nightmare before Christmas.
But not these suburbanite, they look like two characters out of like a waffle commercial in the 50s. Is what the two leads look like. That's what they look like.
Number one, she's a seamstress in terms of my worst scenes. And she has to sew with a sewing machine while she watches TV, while she's making popcorn. So that's a little bit of a spoiler. But that is like the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Don't pop Jiffy Pop in the tinfoil. Have we learned nothing from the Scream movies? When Drew Barrymore put that Jiffy Pop on, her life was over.
But Mike, this is where you're a genius. You foreshadowed what an idiot she is because the pickles and the mustard thing. So now we know that she likes to do all these crazy weird combinations of things at once.
Yes, that's what I was going for.
Yeah. So,
not just irrational anger.
No, but it's well-founded. Again, we got a good writer here, Gary Dauberman. We should give him more of the benefit of the doubt.
This is a fine script. I just hate these characters.
True.
Is that fair to say? Because she is pretty much helpless for the most part.
And I wonder if that's a director kind of being a cinematography, more of a aesthetic guy focused on that. If he just kind of, you know, yada-yadded some of the script or changed some of the script in order to just solve what he wanted to do artistically.
Could be.
Because you don't have like a writer-director necessarily.
Right.
And James Wan is very story-based.
And this
producer.
Is cinematic. Right. I mean, there are some really impressive shots in this. And there's some really, the aesthetic, when there's writing on the ceiling.
Oh,
the
look of this
movie
is beautiful. Awesome,
yeah. So there is, you could see.
And that's
definitely
a major selling point. But to get back to where we were, so look, there's a cultist attack, which I think is a cool draw for this
whole thing.
Again, it's
loved it.
Like the paranormal investigation element of the Conjuring script, you have the cult murder.
I thought that was
spree.
So cool. And so well
yeah, you have a
too.
Real life element to this script, and you have that mixture of, you know, all right, we got Chucky and Child's Play, all right, that's a draw, it's always been,
right,
and now we throw in the Manson family stuff, all right. I mean, we just saw it on True Detective season one a while back, where they're talking about occult murders being the big thing,
right,
and the big craze at the end of whatever the 80s
Satanism and pale Satan and the pagan rituals and all that were I mean, those were pop culture fears before terrorism was a thing.
Right.
Like in the early 80s and stuff. You go back on YouTube, go look at some old news stories. Those were like Sally Jesse would cover them. Phil Donahue had an episode.
Why do I know those names? Anyway, I keep...
I'm all over the place.
I keep building
I'm sorry.
Up to this... non-joke. But so essentially, if you were attacked by a cult, Mike, why would you allow an ugly doll to still live in your house?
Well, to his credit, he doesn't. Right? He throws it out.
They throw it out. All right. So why would you, if the doll comes back,
yes.
why would that not like sound every alarm bell in the history of the world?
Why would you decide to keep it?
I know. They just keep going back to their regular, all right, we'll just go back to our regular way of doing it. We got a baby in the other room. We got whatever. I'll sew while watching TV, while popping popcorn. I mean, you deserve to have your house burned down and have your finger broken up. And then, of course, look, I get that in a movie you're scared, but if you're at the top floor of an abandoned devil hotel and you don't know how to work an elevator, like where you just push the door close button, but you don't, and every time the door closes, it opens back up again because you didn't push down. You didn't push the first floor button. You don't know how to use an elevator. You're an idiot. I watched that scene twice. I rewound it, watched it again. It's a little bit of a spoiler. She hit one button, which was close the door. She won't hit the other button that says go down. Like, how does nobody in the,
you
the script
two
department not know?
Shouldn't have a baby.
She is a moron. She's the dumbest character in the history of the world.
Okay, let's talk about some positives, because there's a lot of negatives in this, and I think the critical scores highlight that. But it's a fun horror movie, and it made a lot of money. And why did it make a lot of money? Because it is a decent horror movie. Why is it a decent horror movie? The scares in this made me jump. There are some that are terrifying. When she has to look under the door, this is my best scene, when she has to look under the door and she sees the terrifying things that are happening to her baby as the doll is trying to get her baby, and then Annabelle's face looks at hers through the door. Annabelle's eyes in this whole movie are awesome, but in that scene, scared the hell out of me.
Yes, multiple jump scares in this movie. I'm yelling out at the TV multiple times throughout this watch for good reasons and for bad reasons.
Agree.
And one of the good reasons, and we're not going to give this spoiler up, but there's a scene that is genuinely horrifying in this movie. And for a few minutes there, you are squirming.
It made me groan. When I saw this in theaters when it came out in 2014, I groaned out loud then. I rewatched it for only the second time yesterday. I knew that scene was coming. I knew the payoff to it, and I still groaned out. I was like, oh God.
Right.
It just tears up your inside.
I never seen it years ago. I passed it over, and I saw it for the first time. I was freaking out.
It's disgusting.
I was freaking out.
It's really disgusting.
So if you want to be freaked out in
it's a mind trick. I mean, it plays with you. It wants that visceral reaction.
There's one of those in this movie. Now, all right, so I walk away from this. Mike, I am not a true believer, so...
God, I can't wait until you get infested with demons.
Yeah, so I believe in nothing, Lebowski. I'm just not believing any of this crap. It comes back to me, like, if these forces existed, why wouldn't they act like a predator, like all the other predators in the world? All the other predators in the world are just going to sneak up on you and kill you.
Because you have to invite them in. Did you learn nothing from this movie?
Didn't it's so care? Dumb! No!
You have to offer your soul up.
All right, so I guess I bookended my best and worst with worst. But
we're going to sit down at our next recording, and you're going to be stoic and not say a word. Your eyes are just going to be all black. Yes. Mike, you look different.
For the last few segments here, we'll kind of rip through them. The best fit in terms of its Warren cinematic universe is the green that this movie made. The money that's over its budget.
This, like we said, the audience attention is how sequels of sequels get made. Right. This is when Warner Brothers knew they can make Warren movies.
We have a universe now because we have a movie with a $6 million budget that made $250 million.
Made a jillion dollars. We have $500 million. Probably $400 of it is profit off two movies.
Right. So obviously you have the kind of true crime, gritty looking home video news report looking prologue epilogue from The Conjuring about the nurses reporting this crime and being interviewed about this crime that was supposedly inflicted upon them by this doll that came to life in The Conjuring. That is also, that starts out this movie, and it's not a huge spoiler, it starts out the damn movie. But so obviously you have the connection to The Conjuring from the jump. Now, we've seen the Marvel Cinematic Universe kind of yada yada those connections. This movie just starts out, here's that first scene connection from the last one.
And I think that's done purpose. I'm convinced that these two movies, they didn't know this was happening. They didn't know Conjuring 3 was a thing. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't know Annabelle 2 was going to be a thing. I think they were just trying to connect two movies together.
Make sure
tie up loose
knew.
Ends. Right. Yeah, okay. And know, and let you know there was a through line. But now I'm excited to see what happens. I mean, I know Slender Man wasn't a big hit, but if we had another substantive horror thing like that, maybe we get Universal's Dark Universe without any of their creatures. You know what I mean? This wide open cinematic universe with all these creepy paranormal things that can tie together without relying on the mummy, the vampire, the Draculas, the Frankensteins, etc.
I just wonder if this is like a cinematic universe of new monsters. Don't people want like new monsters nowadays?
Isn't They're the not... scariest monster just ourselves?
But yeah, I mean, but these are
that
uniquely...
doesn't fit to what you were saying, by the way. I just
no, but you're right. But people adapt, and you know whatever projections we have about the new neuroses and turn them into a demon or a monster. Whatever those projections are, should be constantly changing, right? So the nun as a manifestation of modern anxiety makes more sense than the Frankenstein when science was just, you know, taken on and the becoming a thing in the 18 and 1900s.
Yeah,
and
it's absolutely a reflection of the times, without question.
So it's strange to me why Universal would just stick to their guns about these old horror
movies.
Because
they have the rights to them. Yeah. I mean, that's why, right? They think they're old, reliable. It's the same reason King Arthur movies and Robin Hood movies keep getting made at nauseam. Those are available for everyone, but Universal has the Bela Lugosi, all that stuff in their catalog.
They're spending hundreds of millions of dollars to create that cinematic universe that's failing, and these
this
guys are spending
$26 million, you're right.
Tens of millions to make a just a smash hit.
I think it's an interesting point, too, that we have not seen The Nun yet in either of these two movies.
No.
So it we're going to see it in the next episode we cover, the next two movies, but it's finally going to be introduced. But we're talking The Nun has only been in existence for 3 years now.
Sure.
I mean, now it's getting its own movie. So they obviously, again, didn't know that this was going to be as sprawling as it is.
It's fun because I think they kind of base a lot of these monsters and characters on the relics of the museum and on, you know, maybe they create some. But bottom line is they're like a TV series. When that character bursts onto the scene and becomes a hit, whoever that guest character is in a sitcom
run with them.
In a TV series, they run with that. And of course, they run it with The Nun, just like they ran with... Well, Annabelle seems more on purpose. And then The Nun, yes, it's on purpose that she's a very important character to that Conjuring 2 story. But now you have...
Yeah, Annabelle was more... It was there. Right. And now maybe with Conjuring 2, they're like, let's see if we can get a spinoff somewhere. Let's introduce something that might be intriguing.
Yeah.
So let's introduce our minions.
I wonder if the Crooked Man can work after... The Crooked Man's introduced in Conjuring 2. And we're now going to be 6 years later when the Crooked Man movie comes out. That's a little strange. It's almost too late, isn't it? Shouldn't they have released the Crooked Man? Maybe they decided upon the Nun
rather
than the...
Maybe there's a tie-in with the Nun to the Crooked
Man. It
has
to be.
Some kind of reminder. Yeah, who knows?
That makes no sense. Because they're in a monastery.
Yeah.
They have a Crooked Man thing in there. That would seem a little forced. But honestly, we don't even know the reviews for the nun yet.
No clue. I mean, it's coming out in 7 days. Yeah.
Yeah, Warner Brothers is notorious for keeping those under wraps. So, all right. I mean, we're going to have two of these preview episodes for you folks. But this is number one. We did a lot of talk on the cinematic universe factor to tie everything in.
Yeah, by the way, I'm Mike One. That was also Mike. I didn't do that at the top of the show. But
did you?
We're looking forward to The Nun. We love reviewing horror movies. We're trying to do more horror-centric stuff as we get in October, but we're always going to keep an eye towards the Oscars. As you know, we're with you multiple times a week with that in mind. If you like these reviews, or if you have seen them, you want to hear something else, you want to say something else about either of these movies, let us know. Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Twitter. Nope, Mike and Oscar on Instagram.
Yes.
MM and Oscar on Twitter. I finally screwed up after all these episodes.
You had it going there for a while. Well, you're rattled after discussing the horror movie.
I'm terrified right now. I peed myself. Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram.
Oh, that's what that is.
And Oscar on Twitter, MikeMikeAndOscar@gmail.com, MikeMikeAndOscar.com on Reddit as well. Mike, any final words of wisdom here?
We have a massive catalog of episodes. We did the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the Mission Impossible films there. We've done previews every month where The Nun is involved. And if you're looking at the next month worth of movie going and the next few months, really, we've also done Oscar trailer episodes. So my words of wisdom are, go back and listen to our back catalog because we got a ton of stuff there for you. Sometimes, these episodes, they don't get as many hits at the time, and a lot of people go back to them, so we're thrilled with that fact. And I think most of our stuff has a long shelf life. So, like, yes, we have some that just, you know, play for a month or sometimes a news episode, but most of those episodes have a long shelf life. Listen to them.
Yeah, we do that in mind. We want to always keep you abreast of what's going on and happening now. And if you get to it later on, we give you kind of a guidebook to listen along with if you feel so inclined. But yes, your wise words of listen to us, I agree with.
Yeah, so listen to us and, yeah, like our earlier work.
Yeah, I agree. And if you could leave us a shout out on iTunes, that'd be cool too.
That'd be awesome.
Whatever. We're not here to pressure you.
Thanks a lot. I hope we're.
Reality sucks, guys. Keep watching movies with us. We will check you out next time. And thanks for listening.
See ya.
Cherish is the word I use to describe.